Hello, pals, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week uncovers the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week we're picking through entrails, staring at comets and watching the flights of birds to uncover the secrets of tomorrow. In preparation for this episode, I've had a quick read of Nostradamus' sports almanac and can reveal some pretty shocking predictions. In the C-Zone 2021, the magpie will bow to Moorish coin. A Viking will lead the Red Devils astray, and verily, an unkempt tax-dodging Latino will continue hoarding golden orbs. Also, it's worthwhile sticking 10 ducats on Arsenal in the most corners market this evening. Oh, hang on, not this evening, because he's writing it in the 16th century. Also, it's worth sticking...
yeah, that's why the logic falls down. Yeah.
Also, it is worthwhile sticking 10 ducats on Arsenal in the most corners market on the evening of 6th December 2021. And I can also predict with the regularity of medieval prophets with a hard-on for the end of the world that joining me as my co-host is Barry McStay.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that too.
In fact, the listeners could probably turn the podcast off now. If they're anywhere near as good as we are, they know exactly what the decision at the end of the show is going to be.
Yeah, you're going to pick your own as winner.
I unfortunately don't have that power today.
Oh, no, you don't, because I'm hosting it. But, I know we've got a couple of listeners who've gone back through all the shows and have, like, sussed out a chart of whether you've won, I've won, or the guest has won. But I think another chart needs to be of how many times you've picked your own choice as well.
I dispute that, sir. I think, actually, in fairness, when they did the research, the numbers came up fairly... I was going to say 50-50, but 33.33 recurring, 33.33 recurring, 33.33 recurring, you, me, or guest winning. Which is I don't know, is that good odds? Is that what should have happened? I don't really know how that sort of version of probability works.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of like, you know, if you flip a coin.
A three-sided
3,000
coin.
Times. A three-sided coin, yes. Precisely. I'm glad that we are very fair arbiters of the mediocre and the heroically failing.
Tell you what, there's a lot of pressure on you today to now not pick your candidate at the end of this.
There really is.
While Ben mulls on that particular dilemma, let me introduce our guest. Our guest this week is a comedian who gigs all over the UK and abroad. He comes with a self-described slight bespectacled frame and scruffy hair, but under this disarming armour he conceals an array of razor-sharp, quirky one-liners like a quipping mugger. He's a former BBC New Comedy Award finalist, the winner of Harrogate Comedian of the Year, and has also written for BBC Radio 4's The News Quiz, The Show What He Wrote, and Newsjack. He has an impressive CV on the road too, providing support for Alexei Sale, Jonathan Pye, Arthur Smith, Jason Manford and Paul Sinha. Providing support, that is, by telling jokes, not just by giving them encouraging pep talks or slices of oranges at the end.
I do that as well. You know, yeah.
Jason Manford loves his halftime orange. He also co-hosts the podcast Chats Over Coffee with my yoga teacher. Skip ahead now if you don't want to know what it's about, listeners. Where he chats with his yoga teacher over coffee. About mindfulness and yoga, which in my experience is 75% of one's interactions with yoga teachers. Called A Great Comic by BBC Radio 4, Compellingly Hilarious by Chortle, and Yorkshire's Answer to Woody Allen by The Harrogate Observer, which is very much a double-edged sword.
Well, that was a good quote 10 years ago.
Yes, and I want to footnote that I like that quote is at the very bottom of his website where you really have to scroll down to find it.
I'd love it if they've updated it to now Yorkshire's Answer to Bill Cosby. Yeah. Yorkshire's Answer to Louis C.K. It's our most problematic guest ever, Barry.
Please welcome Yorkshire's Answer to Peter Brush. Peter Brush.
I didn't self-describe myself in that first passage that says nice things about me, by the way. Someone else wrote that.
I was taking this like bespectacled frame and scruffy hair as the self-description. No,
a friend of mine, he wrote that for me because I didn't know what to write for myself, and I thought, well, because I can't talk myself up very well, you know.
It's nice to have a guest on who admits to not having written the bio on their website.
No, I wrote the other things, like the factual things, like here are some factual quotes that people have said, and here's the factually accurate thing that I had written for a BBC show one afternoon.
But the opinion stuff, you leave that to friends.
No. Yeah, even though that's all probably factually correct as well. Very funny in that.
I've always wanted to ask, because Ben, you haven't done this sort of thing, but what is it like going on the road and supporting like a totemic figure like Alexi Sayle or like a big current comedian like Jason Manford or Paul Sinner, the likes of those?
I'm not really in awe of anybody, so I'm like, I don't mean that in a whole, I don't respect their, like, obviously brilliant comedians. I never actually watched Jason on stage before. Absolute natural. And obviously Alexi's got this massive sort of, you know, the godfather of alternative comedy, isn't he? So he's got all this gravitas and weight behind him and stuff. So that was, it's very cool to do. Maybe I'm not deferential enough when I meet these people, but I'm not really that asked, you know.
As far as I understand, when you meet Alexi Sayle, you're expected to kiss his signet ring, roll out a prayer mat and prostrate yourself before him.
It's frankly disgraceful that Peter's come on the podcast and hasn't offered us piles of gold, frankincense and myrrh. He's just sat on the end of Zoom giving us both the finger. The level of deference is so low.
Well, it's got me into trouble before, but I really sound like a prick here, but I just want to talk. I was about to say I want to talk to him as equals, as if I am but that makes me sound like some arsehole relative of yours that pops into the green room once and like starts like trying to chat with everybody as if they're on the same level and they're not, so maybe I'm that guy.
It's a really tricky thing to do. It's really difficult when you gig with someone who is enormous and they do act like they are so much better than you. Two things that I've thought of. One is I'm obviously currently balls deep in the Beatles documentary, and I was listening to someone talk about Paul McCartney. And whenever Paul McCartney meets someone, he really tries to just be a normal guy, because he knows that you meeting Paul McCartney is absolutely going to be one of the top five experiences of your life. And so he tries to undercut it and downplay it. But it makes me think of, so I, earlier this year, got a gig with Dara O'Brien a couple of times, and he is one of my absolute comedy heroes. And I know that Dara is a brilliant, down-to-earth kind of guy. And so we were chatting in the green room about comparing and crowd work and what it was like to do it. And I was speaking to him going, you know, we're two comedians talking about what we do and it's all kind of similar. But I know in reality it was like a Sunday league footballer speaking to Lionel Messi about what we do being similar. I don't know how else to have that conversation, because it's, you know, we're both professional comedians. Just he is considerably more successful and talented than I am.
Mm. I'm not arguing with that.
Thank you, Peter.
I honestly think it's held me back a little bit, because I'm quite good friends with Fern Brady, and she's told me off in the past for not networking properly by just being like, I don't know, not rude, but like, no, I just won't do it.
that kind of leads us on very neatly to ask you what you consider yourself worst at in the world.
There's a lot of things I'm bad at. Everyone's bad at lots of stuff. So I tried to compile a list, and gargling, very bad at gargling.
Like, did you compile this list in a particular order?
I did my teeth, I was like, oh yeah, job done.
Do you try and nail your dental hygiene and find that you're actually waterboarding yourself?
Sort of, yeah. Well, I'm really bad at doing the bit at the end of the mouthwash, and I go, whoa, and then I immediately sort of gag.
Please don't try it on the podcast. If you're that bad at it, you might sort of choke yourself. And we're not in the same room to try to give you the Heimlich or pull your tongue back out again.
I mean, I do it every day. So it's a reminder every day about how bad I am at something. But I mean, that's not an exciting thing to talk about, is it, gargling? but I think I'm notably bad at gargling. And it's not just...
Mate, it is the talk of green rooms on the Northwest Circuit.
Yeah. I chew a lot of gum. I don't know how much good that does.
The poor man's gargle, they call it.
Yeah. Well, some of us have to do it because we're not physically capable of gargling. So, careful what you're saying. You're treading a fine line there of discrimination. So there are other things that I'm not very good at. I mean, social interactions are probably every other comedian will tell you that. But what I'm not good at is meeting people that I have to be nice to. Like, I'm always told off by my other half when we meet people that are her friends that I won't make any effort to be nice to anybody that I don't know by asking, you know, the stuff that you're supposed to say, like, oh, so what do you do? And pretending to be interested in stuff. And I'll just be rude, but because not so, to, I just I won't stop myself from saying something that I think is amusing, but they would have to have known me for years to know that that was me being trying to be funny and not being an arsehole. So that's a problem. But
so you're not great at comparing in social situations.
No, although I've compared two gigs in the last month at the weekends, which is very. I told Toby Jones that the other day, and he went, "You." I was like, yeah, thank you. I don't know whether you know, everybody was ill that day or something. One of you won't notice, but
I really want you, Peter, to end up doing the Royal Variety Show sometime. And then you know, when they do the lineup at the end and Prince Charles comes along and goes, "Oh, what do? You know, mind your own fucking business."
Yes. The sort of interesting thing that maybe I'm bad at, only from a familial perspective, is my dad was a professional footballer and I am very bad at football. And
what position did your dad play?
He played left back. So I'm also right-footed. So again, that's...
Oh, you know. No.
But he does look a bit like me. I'm not saying like it's not that we had an exceptionally bad at football milkman that, like, you know, or anything. But when I went to secondary school, for some reason, people knew in advance who he was. And so when they used to do like pick the football team and stuff like that, I was like first pick for like a week. And then they were like, "Oh, he must have been having an off day. So we'll do it again." And then I slowly found myself like falling further and down the pecking order in the playground. And I went to the same school as Alvin Martin's kids, and they were actually really good at football. I think the two of them, I think they both became professional in the end.
Were Alvin Martin's kids called Simon and Theodore?
Do you want the
sorry? That's...
Do you want a serious answer? his kids were Joe Martin, who I can't remember. I think he played outfield somewhere, and Dave Martin, who was in goal for Liverpool, Wimbledon, and MK Dons, and West Ham recently, because it was a big thing on Match of the Day when he finally played for West Ham.
Yes.
And his dad, and he was like, he's like a year younger than me, so he was like 34 or something when he got that game. So, but it was still,
I do remember that.
It was a nice thing for him.
There are only two Alvins that I know of in history. There's Alvin Martin and Alvin Stardust, who was kind of like a Poundland glam rocker.
Yeah, I don't know any other Alvins, actually. I've just typed Alvin into Wikipedia, and yeah. Alvin and the Chipmunks comes up. Alvin Martin doesn't, and neither does Alvin Stardust.
Oh, I'd be furious if I was a club legend for West Ham and I'd been outdone by a fictional chipmunk.
Alvin York is the top one, who is one of the most decorated US Army soldiers of World War One. So all your American listeners will be thinking, you haven't mentioned Alvin York yet, so... But well, apparently we have. So,
but does Alvin York speak in an annoyingly high helium voice? You see,
I don't know. Is there an audio clip on the wiki?
Charge. Right, so this week we are talking about the world's worst predictions. And Barry, you're going to go first.
I know what some of you are thinking. Some of you have predicted that I'm going to lead with Nostradamus, but I'm not. I'm going to lead with Michael Fish. Our British listeners will know Michael Fish. Our listeners outside this country will be baffled by the very concept that someone called Michael Fish exists who is actually a human and not a fish.
I believe there's a... Is there not a podcast that debates the existence of Michael Fish?
There's no such thing as Michael Fish, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what it's called, yeah.
Michael Fish was a BBC weatherman for our non-British listeners, and famously in 1987 on the 15th of October he said during the weather forecast, "Earlier on today apparently a woman rang the BBC and said she heard there was a hurricane on the way. Well, if you're watching, don't worry, there isn't." And a few hours later the great storm of 1987 broke. It was the worst hit southeast England in 300 years, causing record damage and killed 19 people. And in reaction to that, there was a thing called the Michael Fish effect, whereby apparently British weather forecasters are now inclined to predict a worst case scenario in order to avoid being caught out. So there's a suggestion that the weather forecast is wrong because British weather forecasters err on the side of things being terrible.
The Michael Fish effect are an awful prog rock band.
Yes. There's also the term the Michael Fish moment, which is public forecasts on any topic which turn out to be embarrassingly wrong, which is very appropriate for this podcast. Michael Fish himself said in an interview there was actually no woman who called in, although apparently over the years lots of people have claimed to be that person. He just thought it was a really good opening line to a weather forecast. That earlier that day he was with a colleague who was telling him about his mother going to Florida, and his mother had heard there was going to be a storm in Florida. So he thought it was a good line to open a weather forecast with. And he's also, in later years, said that he was actually referring to that hurricane that was going to hit Florida. He's saying, oh, I wasn't really talking about the south of England at all. But he never mentions Florida at all in the weather forecast. So it seems like a crucial detail to leave out.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether that's what I want from my weather people, for them to go, do you know what this weather forecast needs? Hollywood opening.
Yeah, it's such a sort of famous broadcast moment that actually a little clip of it was shown as part of a video montage in the London 2012 Olympics opening ceremony.
Do you think this is where the seeds of Brexit came from? Like people not trusting the experts anymore?
Yeah. Michael Fish. Fish at the centre of so many of the Brexit issues, as we've learned. Famously, in August 1995, another BBC talking head, on this occasion, Match of the Day pundit Alan Hansen, criticised the Manchester United manager, Sir Alex Ferguson. Alex Ferguson's new-look Manchester United side had just lost 3-1 to Aston Villa on the opening day of the football season. Alan Hansen famously said, you can't win anything with kids. And Manchester United went on to win the Premier League that season and the FA Cup. They won the double with a team whose average age was 26 years and 137 days. I think the second youngest team to ever win the Premier League. And obviously went on to dominate the Premier League for the ensuing half a decade, basically. My favourite prediction that I came across in researching this was actually some people who predicted something that did happen. Mm-hmm. There was a real trend in the run-up to the Titanic sinking of fiction and short stories and novels about big ships sinking in the Atlantic due to lack of lifeboats. There was loads of them. There was a book called The Futility or The Wreck of the Titan, written in 1898 by American Morgan Robertson. A ship called the Titan is called unsinkable and hits an ice shelf, sinking off the coast of Newfoundland. It's described as having very similar dimensions to the Titanic as well, and hits the ice at almost the same speed of the Titanic, and is described as having not enough lifeboats. And that features in a lot of fiction. It features in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. There's a Doctor Who audio drama, The Wreck of the Titan, inspired by this story. There's another book called The Ship's Run, written in 1908 by M. MacDonald Bodkin. The ship in this story is actually called the Titanic. In the story, he calls it the largest and fastest passenger boat afloat. However, the ship was being constructed at this time. The real Titanic was being constructed. So the suggestion is maybe he took the name from having read news reports about it. There's The White Ghost of Disaster, a short story by Thornton Jenkins Haynes, published in 1912, literally as the Titanic was setting sail, about a ship called the Admiral, an 800-foot ocean liner who hits an iceberg at 22.5 knots in the North Atlantic. Again, very similar to the Titanic, didn't have enough lifeboats to go around. But the most striking one of these is The Sinking of a Modern Liner, written in 1886, quite a long time beforehand, by the famous English journalist W.T. Stead. And Stead was trying to warn the public about increasingly large ships not having enough lifeboats. And so he wrote a short story called How the Mail Steamer Went Down in Mid-Atlantic by a Survivor, which was published in the Pall Mall Gazette. Again, an ocean liner leaves Liverpool, journey to New York City. And even in this, the captain in the ship brandishes a revolver to keep steerage passengers from storming the lifeboats, which didn't happen on the Titanic, but is one of those details that James Cameron stuck into the film. But the thing I love about this story is that W.T. Stead, who wrote this, was on board the Titanic and drowned in April 1912.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You love that he drowned, didn't you?
I love that this old journalist was last seen bobbing around, hanging onto a plank.
You'd have think that if this guy genuinely had the foresight that sort of thing was a problem, he wouldn't have got on the bloody Titanic in the first place, would he?
Yeah, his own work was about how dangerous all these ships were and they never have enough lifeboats, but it didn't stop him wanting to.
It's like a doctor that smokes, isn't he?
Yeah, he's exactly that. Yeah, it's one of those eerie foretellings of his own death. I mean, he wrote lots of things about, you know, various workplace dangers, so it was bound to get one of them right, it turns out. But I'm going to go for my world's worst prediction quite early, and it is literally every prediction by Sylvia Brown. If you don't know who Sylvia Brown is, I have a particular bugbear about Sylvia Brown. She is She is, as her Wikipedia article says, an American author who claimed to be a medium with psychic abilities. Rather than saying an American psychic, which kudos to whoever wrote that Wikipedia article. But she was one of those people who would write lots of self-help books and would appear on chat shows like Montel Williams and Larry King. She hosted a radio show. She, like a lot of mediums and psychics, had her own phone line where people could ring to ask for consultations to help. Apparently, at the time of her death, I think the waiting list to get through to her was like 4 years long. She would go on cruise ships around the world where people would pay to be on the cruise as well, and they would attend sessions with her. I'll give you some of her backstory, and these should give you some red flags about why you would not want to trust this woman as far as you could throw her. She was a convicted criminal, having faced the charges of theft in 1992. In the late 1980s, the FBI began to invest her over several bank loans that had caused sustained losses to banks, and she and her husband were indicted on charges of investment fraud and grand theft, and she was found to have sold securities under false pretenses. They told one couple that their $20,000 investment was to be used for immediate operating costs. Instead, she transferred it to a different company, received 1 year probation, and was sentenced to 200 hours of community service. A bigger red flag, I would suggest, is the fact that Sylvia Brown was married 4 times. If you can't predict that your marriage is not going to go well.
Yeah, but that's not a great thing to do. Like, what do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a seer and a prophetess. And how do you feel about this relationship? Yeah, I give us 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
I definitely signed the prenup.
Yeah. Yeah. She also had a lot of books on the New York Times bestseller list. But to give you an example of the sort of thing that she would do, in 2006, there was an explosion at a mine in West Virginia which trapped several miners underground. And she was a guest on a radio program the next day. And at the start of the broadcast, they believed that 12 of the 13 miners trapped by this disaster had been found alive. And when the radio host, George Noory, asked Brown if, oh, the lack of noise inside the mine might have led her to think the men had died, she replied, no, I knew they were going to be found. Later on, in the same program, news reports came in that those reports were wrong. Some of the men had indeed died. And Brown said, I don't think there's anybody alive. Maybe one. I just don't think they are alive. And later on, she adds, I didn't believe that they were alive. I did believe that they were gone. Literally reversing her own prediction on a live radio broadcast. But the thing that really winds me up is that she would go particularly on shows like Montel, American TV chat shows, and she would predict or try and locate the missing children of grieving parents.
Oh no, that's horrible.
Yeah. For example, 1999, she said 6-year-old Opal Joe Jennings, who had disappeared a month beforehand, had been forced into slavery in Japan. Later that year, a local man was convicted of kidnapping and murdering Jennings, and in 2003, her remains were found, or she proved that she had died within hours of her abduction. None of this is going to be funny, by the way, folks. Just a heads up.
Oh, good. Okay, great. Well, that's just what we're after, Barry, as we enter the darkest months of the year.
You're all very welcome. I have been holding Sylvia Brown back for the most perfect podcast I could find for her. 2002, she claimed that a woman called Holly Cruson, who disappeared 7 years beforehand, was working as an exotic dancer in Hollywood. Her 2006 dental records were shown, showed that her body had been found in 1996. She also told the parents of 11-year-old Sean Horbeck, who had disappeared earlier that year, that he'd been kidnapped by a dark-skinned Hispanic man with dreadlocks and was now dead. Hornbeck, happily, was found alive in 2007, with his kidnapper being Caucasian and short-haired. Huh. And in 2004, she told the parents of Amanda Berry. This was a reasonably famous story, the last decade. Amanda Berry, who disappeared a year and a half before. She's not alive, honey. She's not alive. She's in water. I've had a vision of her jacket in the garbage with DNA on it. Berry's mother died 2 years later, believing her daughter had been killed. And Amanda Berry, as I think people might remember, was found alive in 2013.
Until you started telling us about these predictions about people who she said were dead but actually alive, I was going to say that she's got a real sort of Angela Lansbury in Murder, She Wrote vibe. She keeps predicting dead people and she doesn't quite get the details right, but it feels like she's covering her tracks.
Yeah. My favourite one, on Larry King Live in 2003, Sylvia Brown predicted she would die at the age of 88. She died at the age of 77.
Banging. Love it.
Final nail in the coffin of Sylvia Brown, who died in 2013. She was in the news during COVID. Social media users pointed out that there was a prediction in several of her books, End of Days and Prophecy, What the Future Holds for You, which referred to the COVID pandemic. She claimed a severe pneumonia-like illness would spread around 2020.
Okay, that's pretty good.
I mean, yeah, sure. The likes of Kim Kardashian and others posted about this online. Investigator Benjamin Radford dismissed the one-paragraph prediction as too generic because basically, for the last 15 years, people have been predicting that something like SARS was going to affect planet Earth and we needed to be ready. And we've all known for years that international travel was going to be a hotbed for the spread of a pandemic like this. So Radford said that as Brown had produced predictions by the thousands, the fact that this one happened to possibly maybe be partly right is utterly meaningless.
A stopped prophet will tell the right prophecy twice a century.
Yeah.
Did you get anything right? You've got to build up a bit of credibility, haven't you, before you start? You know, it's like being a really good sports person or like a one-hit wonder or something. You've got to have one hit early on so that people will go, like, listen to you in the first place. You know,
I think with most of these, it's just being generic enough. You go, oh, someone here is in a lot of pain. And there's always someone who's in pain in a room of, you know, however many people. And they just want to hear you say, oh, yeah, your relative is fine.
Yeah, so just a charlatan then, you mean? Like,
not... Yeah.
I mean, they're bad predictions, obviously, but in a way, I just sort of feel, well, she's just trying to make money and be relevant and stuff. So it's not...
If you predict someone's child is alive and their child ends up dead, you might want to stop predicting where children are.
Yeah.
And she really doubled down on that. stick to maybe lost pets.
Yeah. Work your way up. Yeah, she's really trying to run before she can walk with the predictions there, isn't she?
Yeah, she is.
It's like Schrodinger's child, isn't it?
Oh, God.
You have now forced me to Google whether Schrodinger had any children.
God, Schrodinger must have been tedious while his wife was pregnant.
Yes.
That baby in your belly is both dead and alive. Stop it, Irwin. Stop it.
He did have children. Several of them by different women other than his wife.
Oh, you're telling me Schrodinger was a player? Because
yeah.
Schrodinger was going, to be honest, we are both married and not married. If you're not, if I can't see you, you both are my wife and are not my wife, and so I can play away from home.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never been very comfortable with like spooky predictions and stuff. Like the Nostradamus type things, always scared. Like, do you remember when 9/11 happened and they found a passage in Nostradamus that was really quite eerily similar, actually, in fairness, to what happened in a way? Something like, in the year 2000, two twin brothers will fall and the third great war starts or something. And it was seemed really like that kind of clips with the events of mm-hmm. that. And so I've always been quite scared by people that sort of claim to be able to make predictions, because I guess it's that the certainty is also supernatural kind of in a way to be able to do that. So the idea of it kind of frightened me, whether it's actually anyone can actually do it or not. I was too old to really sort of fixate on this, but someone at school told me that they could sort of see into the future a bit, and they were clearly dicking about, but they told us, several of us, that they could predict when we were going to die and how we were going to die. And I was supposed to die when I was like 30 for being shot out of a cannon. Like, that's obviously like ridiculous, isn't it, to say? But even though I logically sort of knew that was a ridiculous thing to be told, I still sort of was quite scared about that. I was thinking, well, surely I've got to, like, just when I'm 30, just like someone invites me into a cannon, I just say, oh, do you know what, mate? I've just had a big lunch. I'll skip the cannon ride today. But then I thought, if I do avoid the cannon ride, then is it going to be like Final Destination and something else? And we'll get, because I mean, being shot out of a cannon is not like the worst way to go, I don't think, is it?
Well, I mean, the going bit will be fun. It's the arriving bit that seems
less
fun.
Yeah, it's the It's not bad for your Wikipedia entry, though, is it, really?
No. But what if it's like they mean like a Canon camera and you're being having a photo shoot with a Canon camera?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, well,
and,
that's...
And you get airbrushed out of it.
That's very clever. That's almost Shakespearean, isn't it? Like the that's like the woods of whatever starting to walk. You're like, oh, that never happened. But
by woman born.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah. But anyway, I'm over 30. I haven't been near any Canons. So that turned out to be a false prediction from my friend that was dicking about when we were like, I was about 18 when I got told that as well. You think I was just like, but just the very fact that someone can tell you something with a vague sense of certainty really freaks me out a little bit.
I know what you mean. Like I don't really believe, obviously, in mediums. I would never go and get my palm read just in case they say something a little bit freaky. It's sort of the same thing as, you know, I don't believe in ghosts. Would I go and stay in a haunted house for $1 million? No, I would not.
Yeah. There's like my nan, and she won't mind me saying this. She's had two people come up to her and said that they can tell she's had miscarriages.
What?
I mean, that is a terrible pickup line.
But also, like, about 20% of pregnancies end in miscarriages.
When I said that, because obviously she's like 93 or something, when I said that to someone else, saying it was a bit weird that someone like had said that to, because one of them was someone that just came up to her at work once and said, oh, I can tell you've, you know, it's a bold opening gambit, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the other one was my aunt goes to mediums because of dead relatives. So she wants to, she's into it. And one of them told her that, you know, but they use little tricks, obviously, like they're, but my aunt didn't know that my nan had had a miscarriage before she'd mentioned it and said, oh, have you had? And then so she had. But when I said this to someone else, I said, well, yeah, it's like, especially that age range, quite a high proportion of people would have had miscarriages, but they wouldn't have spoken about it. So it's a good, statistically, it's quite a good guess, like, but do these people go up to people and say, oh, you've had, and then like 4 out of 5 times they're completely incorrect? I mean, then you just like, you know, no, you idiot. Anyway, it freaks me out a little bit, but I know that they use little tricks sometimes. But
well, so I think there's sort of two factors at play. If you're doing like a group setting thing, like you do, like you see these, you know, psychic shows on TV and whatever, you've an audience of however many people, you can say, you know, has someone here lost someone whose name begins with J?
Oh yeah, someone will have.
There's a lot of names begin with J. Or but alternatively, if you're running a phone line, if someone rings you, they're looking for something. They want you to say something.
But you're the captive audience, aren't you? Yeah. You've gone to a medium because you want to speak to a dead person, so you've already like bought in as well, aren't you? So
yeah, exactly. So
I don't believe it, but I know that Ian Tom Binns, when he was researching this Ian de Montfort character, sort of trained himself to do some of these psychological tricks. I know he does jokes about it on stage for his act because he does the fake psychic act, but he did sort of immerse himself into these little, not magic circle, but because I think he said a lot of people that do it actually believe that they can do it, but they've sort of like tricked themselves into thinking that what they're doing is like real, but it's not. Anyway, I haven't come up with a bad prediction apart from the Canon thing, have I? So so the other things, obviously there's that bloke in America that some Baptist minister keeps predicting the rapture and it doesn't happen. Like, you'd think you've done that once, you think, well, you know, again, like we're not selling all our possessions another time.
Do you know what? It's got to be so annoying when one of the Baptist ministers predicts the rapture and the rapture finally happens. Because then he'd be like, you see, like, no, there's like a litany of people who've gotten this wrong. We'll all be tramping off into hell or heaven or wherever. Yeah.
That's going to be the annoying bit, I think, going to hell. Not that the guy was right, I think.
It'll be his smug face as I pass on the escalator down to Satan's boudoir. That's what I'm least looking forward to.
I'll tell you, who else is bad at predictions? Everybody on my Facebook when there is an election.
Yes.
I know, obviously, partly that's, you know, echo chambery sorts of things, like, oh, Labour seems to be doing well this time. I feel really positive that I read a book in the last year or 2 years, which I thought was quite relevant, called Thinking Fast and Slow. Have you heard of that? It's by Daniel Kahneman. He won a Nobel Prize in economics kind of for it, because there isn't a Nobel Prize in psychology. But a lot of it's about how we don't think in empirical evidence ways. Like when we see things, we don't analyze it empirically, like mathematically. We just create stories in our minds. So a lot of his research suggested that obviously a lot of the time we're quite good at creating stories in our minds that are very realistic. You know, like you see something and you interpret it the correct way, like, oh, there's a threat, and you create the story in your mind. Like, if I don't do something now, that lion will get me, blah, 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 blah. But there are occasions often when it comes to statistics or like probabilities and stuff where we actually get things very, very wrong, because we create stories in our mind as the way we think. We are quite prone to give too much credence to weird outcomes, because we can. So you know, a lot of people are, in the last American election, I remember seeing a lot of people saying that there's definitely going to be a civil war. And because in our minds, that's a story that, I mean, it's a potential. It's not like it can't happen, but we give too much weight to it in some ways. So a lot of the evidence that he gathers about like the actual outcomes of things that people predict, we'll like give 20% weight to something that has only got a 1% probability and such. And so,
because we're primed to spot the unusual thing.
Yeah, I just give, yeah, pretty much. So, I mean, I remember seeing so many terrible, what have turned out to be very bad takes about things. And a lot of that's because we're in our own sort of chambers and whatever. I think, you know, we should be probably more conscious of that now. But it's also because we do create stories rather than analyze things.
We do go, it's because your brain is tuned to make the worst case scenario. Something that I found very helpful in thinking is if the... Like the classic one is stood on a train platform and you have the urge to jump in front of the train, not because you're depressed and suicidal, just because it's your brain replaying the worst case scenario. And the thing that was the real wake up call for me was not that, was me carrying one of my children up some stairs and my brain going, chuck him over the side. And it's just your brain going, don't actually do that. I'm just letting you imagine what would happen if you did that. And it would be very bad indeed. I think the Civil War prediction thing is slightly different. That, yeah, it is a worst case scenario. But the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, we were like one quick thinking security guard away.
But it didn't happen. And also, would it have involved the rest of American society taking up arms against each other? Is that actually going to happen? I don't know. I mean, unlikely things do happen all the time. But, you know, most of the time you put money on Man City to win and they're going to win. So
I would put money on Man City to win the American Civil War. I just think organizational tactics.
They've got the funding, so
they do.
Definitely.
Pep's preparation level is so high that he'll have prepared for any situation, be it like the gegenpressing of Jurgen Klopp, an opportunity to invade Tallahassee, you know, anything.
But you see it now often, like the way that people were asked questions as to how severely bad they think COVID is in some quarters. They think that, was I listening to something recently, that some Democrat like states believe that hospitalization is like 40% when it's really like 1%. But then on the inverse side, you've got Republican states that just don't pay any mind at all, perhaps. But, you know, but our ideas of the percentage chances of things happening get wildly inflated by the sounds of things because of the way we think. Mm. And so I highly recommend that book. I'm not saying that we're wrong, but we are wrong about a lot. I mean, who hasn't made predictions about what outcomes in elections are going to be in the last 5 years and got all of them right? I mean, barely any. Who did? I mean, I didn't.
And also human rights, it's not just that we overcompensate for spotting threats. It's also, like you say, we either overestimate or underestimate stuff. We will interpret the same data badly depending on how it's sold to us. What I'm trying to say is, if I tell you that something has a 10% chance of happening, you go, oh, Christ, that's quite high. If I tell you it's got a 1 in 10 chance of happening, it'll be like, nah, it's not going
to
happen.
Yeah, it's all priming and stuff like that. That's all in the book as well. It's all things you can be primed to. You know, it's like when people ask you, a pollster asks you something like, who are you going to vote for? They can make the question is so important.
Well, there's a famous bit in the BBC sitcom Yes, Prime Minister from the 80s about polling, which actually I've just got the script of it up here. The Prime Minister has just been given the results of an opinion poll, and it says that 67% of people would be in favour of reintroducing conscription, national service. And so Sir Humphrey, who's the head of the civil service, tells Bernard, his assistant, to get a different opinion poll done where the results are the opposite. And Bernard cannot understand how, if 67% of people have already said they're in favour of conscription, how you could get an opinion poll to say the opposite. So the following exchange takes place. Humphrey asks Bernard Woolley, "Mr. Woolley, are you worried about the rise in crime among teenagers?" "Yes." "Do you think there's a lack of discipline and vigorous training in our comprehensive schools?" "Yes." "Do you think young people welcome some structure and leadership in their lives?" "Yes." "Do they respond to a challenge?" "Yes." "Might you be in favour of reintroducing national service?" "Yes." Now survey two. "Mr. Woolley, are you worried about the danger of war?" This is at the height of the Cold War, so yes. "Are you unhappy about the growth of armaments?" "Yes." "Do you think there's a danger in giving young people guns and teaching them how to kill?" "Yes." "Do you think it's wrong to force people to take up arms against their will?" "Yes." "Would you oppose the reintroduction of national service?" "Yes."
So I've got me being shot out of a cannon. I've got you on Facebook, like the the royal you, and Pele is probably... Pele, the greatest footballer.
For predicting that I'd be able to get a hard-on when I took one of his special pills.
Yeah, well, this makes it even less credible as a salesperson. But he's obviously probably the greatest footballer of all time, notably terrible at making predictions about the thing that he was better at than anyone else. So he's made a series of bad predictions, usually like they'll ask him, you know, before the World Cup. And he's famously said things like in 1998, said Spain will be the favourites, and they went out in the first round. And in 2002, he said China are going to qualify from their group, and they didn't score any goals and lost all their games. Argentina and France will be in the final in 2002, and they both got knocked out in the first round. So basically, if he says that you're going to, you know, because he's championed a couple of players as well, like Nick Barmby, he said was going to be a world-class player up there with... God. And that didn't quite... He's not a bad player, but, you know, it's so weird to be... You could be complimented by the best footballer of all time and think, oh, fuck.
Yeah. No. So, it's like I've been given the black spot.
So Neil Lamptey was another one. It was like a young... I think he was Ghanaian or something. He was like under-17 World Cup, was championed by Pele as my successor. But the best predictions that he made, there's one which when I was reading about it, and it's kind of funny because it's not a real one, but in the film Escape to Victory, he gets fouled in the final, right, by the Nazis. I've never actually seen Escape to Victory, but that sounds so ridiculous. So they're actually playing Nazis in the football match. But okay. Well, he gets injured and they're 4-0 down, and he says there's no way he can continue and that they're doomed. But then he comes on in the second half and scores loads of... So even in a fictitious world, Pele's prediction was incorrect, which is quite charming. But there were... I mean, this is tragic, obviously, but you remember the worst prediction that he obviously made was in 1994, he predicted that Colombia will win the World Cup.
Yes.
And... Well, they didn't, obviously. They went out in the first round, and the defender that scored the own goal, Andres Escobar, that knocked them out, got shot dead by an angry fan when they got back to Colombia, which is really, like, not funny at all. But, like, cheers, Pele.
Literal kiss of death.
Yeah, it really is. I don't know if he... Why would you want him to front your advertising campaign for...
Yeah.
He's sort of like the equivalent of musicians being the worst judges of their own art.
I remember as well, he also said that an African nation would win the World Cup.
Oh, yeah, he did say that, and it hasn't happened yet. But, I mean, you know, African countries have got much better at football and more organised and stuff, so it's not... I don't know. I think they're just asking him for a laugh now. You know, it's like when they had, isn't that when they used to have Mystic Meg before the national lottery numbers and stuff? It's just like, oh, it's just a thing that we do for a laugh, surely. I mean, did anyone take her seriously? I don't know. Did she ever
get... No, I don't think so. But no, but I think it's, you know, how with recent World Cups, we've had Paul the Psychic Octopus and Dave the Psychic Echidna or whatever. And now they should just go, oh, we'll just get Pele the Psychic Human.
But the octopus was frighteningly accurate, though. It wasn't like...
Yeah, for non-football, yeah, it was called Paul. They put two flags up for each team in a tank and it would see which one he'd cling to.
It's like, I mean, especially like when you get great footballers, they're not always great managers, are they? Maybe if you don't think about the game so much, because it's so instinctual, you don't, you know, your analytical skills aren't as good. Is that why lots of great comedians don't become comedy tutors? Sorry, I know that you run a course, Ben. That's not a slur on you at all, by the way. I've just
looked up Paul the Octopus's Wikipedia page, and he was in Germany, so they used to get him to predict the outcome of Germany's Euro and World Cup matches, and indeed the winner of the World Cup final. He amassed an overall record of 12 correct predictions out of 14, a success rate of approximately 85.7%, which is, yeah. We also, as Ben mentioned, had other animals. Leon the Porcupine, Petty the Pygmy Hippopotamus, Anton the Tamarin, Manny the Parakeet, and Rabio the Octopus, who correctly predicted the results of all of Japan's group stage games at the 2018 World Cup, and then was killed and sent to market by the Japanese fisherman who caught it.
Oh no!
Oh my god.
The thing is, that would make a really impressive spine of a team as well. You've got the octopus in the creative number 10 role, you can have the porcupine being the midfield enforcer, hippo in goal.
Then we get a human to predict the result of the match.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, so yeah, and Pele up front, because he's Pele, because, you know, even at 78, 79, Pele can do a job, can't he?
Yeah, on a parakeet.
This might have something to do with going back to thinking fast and slow. It may just be that we'll think too much about our predictions about things and give too much weight to the unexpected things because they're better stories. But the octopus doesn't think the same way. The octopus just instinctively says, yeah, evidence suggests.
He's all about the stats, the octopus.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to your new book coming out next year. Think more like an octopus and less like Pele.
Yeah.
I'm sure they've got, haven't they got like several brains, octopuses that are in?
Yeah, they've nine, but each arm is sort of in an autonomous mini brain.
Yeah.
That's why Brazilians are so good at football as well, is that they actually have mini brains in their legs. Positive racism, ladies and gentlemen.
Is that why Pele can't get it up because it's so big?
It's because it's a tentacle. That's the problem. It won't solidify.
Solidify? Is that the verb you want to use for...
Yes, it is. Pele, come at me.
He's not well at the moment, so this might come out at the wrong time.
Really tempting fate here. Yeah.
Obviously, during the Roman Empire, either being an augur or haruspex was a very important job. Augurs were a particular priestly class who would look at predictions coming specifically from the flights of birds. The etymology of augur may come from the Latin avis for bird and specere, to look, or alternatively it could come from aug, which means to increase or prosper. But they were consulted about what to do before a battle, about large political movements, and who was going to be the next emperor. And then haruspexes were from various different cultures, where they would cut open animals and look at their entrails, particularly the livers. My favorite thing was that, obviously, like all good pseudosciences, they went into extreme detail. So there was different things that augurs would examine. So it wasn't just birds. There would be augury ex kilo, which is augury based on thunder and lightning, ex avibus of birds, ex tripudius, which is attributed to food, in particular, the feeding of sacred chickens. More of this in a moment. Ex quadrupedibus, predictions based on dogs, horses, wolves, and foxes, or ex deeris, which is based on ominous events. And there was a hierarchy amongst the animals that would be used to predict events. Birds that were quite commonly used were ravens, woodpeckers, owls, and eagles. And an eagle would outrank a woodpecker. So if birds were seen doing contradictory things, then it was the eagle that you would pay attention to rather than the woodpecker.
Is that all because they're linked to different gods and things? Because owls are linked to Athena, aren't they?
Almost certainly. Even at the time, people would take the piss out of this. So one of the very famous first comedies written by a classical writer was The Birds by Aristophanes. And in it, Aristophanes has the leader of a chorus of birds who brags of their usefulness in divination, saying, "Before undertaking anything, whether a business transaction, a marriage, or the purchase of food, you consult the birds by reading the omens." The bird also says, "Without you, a word is an omen. You call a sneeze an omen, a meeting an omen, an unknown sound an omen, a slave or an ass an omen." You know, you talked about your choice, Barry, would basically row back on what she'd said just in case. Well, yeah. Because the auguries didn't want to get it wrong, because then they would almost certainly be killed, they had various technical terms where they would sort of use to twist their predictions. So repudiare was where they would refuse to give a prediction through an interpretive sleight of hand, or what I would like to refer to as the Arsene Wenger prediction, where they say non observare assumed that no one had paid attention to them. So they'd go, "Oh, I didn't actually see it."
Yes. Was it Croesus? He wanted to go to war with the Persians and was told that, you know, if you do, a great empire will fall by the Oracle of Delphi. And of course, of course, it's the Lydian Empire that falls, not the Persians.
Yeah. Renunciatio, which is making a distinction between, oh, what I observed and the way I observed it. The way I observed it was correct, but what I actually observed was incorrect. Or even vitia, resorting to acknowledging the presence of mistakes, just openly going, "Oh yeah, I fucked up, really sorry, it's just what happens being an augury."
One of the downsides of this job, where we're meant to predict things accurately, is we can't predict things accurately.
Yeah, absolutely. This is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of strange methods of prediction. In ancient China, bones were used to tell the future, specifically the cracks in bones, or frequently animal shoulder blades, or even tortoise shells. And what would happen is that they would chisel a fissure into it, and then they would get a heated piece of flint or something like that, put it in the crack, and the way the crack would fissure would be used as an interpretation. And there are some scholars who even believe that early Chinese script is based on the fissures in what were known as oracle bones.
Oh, wow.
You also have alectriomancy, which I've already mentioned. That is the specific name for divination using chickens. And according to the New Encyclopedia of Occult...
I'm glad it's had an update.
The most famous of these was Emperor Valens. He was emperor from the year 364 to the year 378 CE, and a group of Roman courtiers sought the name of Valens' successor. So the ceremony was, a circle was drawn and divided up into segments, with each segment corresponded to a certain letter, and a grain of wheat was placed in each segment. And after the ceremony was carried out, the chickens had pecked out the grains corresponding to the letters T, H, E, O, and D, which they very quickly, the courtiers, decided, well, that means a chap called Theodotus, who was a local official who was known to be ambitious. Theodotus wasn't the next emperor because he was immediately killed by Valens.
Did they just keep doing it? Until the chickens refused to eat and he was like, finally, I've got rid of the entire list.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know what tyromancy is?
Tyromancy. No, that's... I was going to say tea, but that's tassiomancy.
No. Peter, any ideas?
It sounds like a romantic... People that light tyres.
No, it was... I mean, it was very often used to predict sort of like who your next love would be. But it is the use of cheese as a divination tool. So either it was looking for the shapes of certain holes in the cheese to be read as initials, not a prediction of which orifice your lover would most enjoy, or it would be the use of mold in cheese. So what would happen would be that they would write the names of prospective husbands and they would place them inside the holes of the cheese, much like Jewish people going to the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem will place things that they want to happen inside the Wailing Wall. And then the piece of cheese that grew mold first, that was nearest to the name of a husband, that would be the one that you were going to end up with.
Because it was like Emmental, it'd just be like O-O initials. Or... Yeah.
Right. But did they stick literal like names in these holes then as well?
Yeah.
But presumably then that means you have to, before this, you have to compile a list of people you think, well, I might marry that person, might marry that person. It's like Roman Tinder.
Yes.
And then you, instead of swiping left or right, you just put the names into a cheese.
Yeah, well, Roman Tinder was called Gouda.
Yeah.
Or the other way of doing it was that they would write the possible answers on separate pieces of cheese, place them inside a cage full of hungry rats and mice, and whichever rat or mouse ate the correct answer first, that would be the person. But I don't know if I'd want to sort of say that to a future husband going, and how did you know that I was the one, my love? Oh, my rat ate your name.
We knew it was love from the moment that that rodent chewed the bit of paper and the mould around.
There's a particularly grim one in Russia. Well, not grim, but it's bleakly Eastern European. This is something called an Under the Bowl songs. In the new year, apparently that is when spirits particularly... active. This part of the year is called Strashinya, the fearful days, and particularly between midnight and 3 a.m. is when they're especially effective. So a popular practice is to place particularly powerful personal objects in a bowl, like rings. Water will be fetched from a well while a young girl speaks the name of a man they want to marry. They pour the water into a bowl along with rings, some oats, some charcoal. They will move around the water with a pinky finger, or ideally, actually, a widow will do this. And at the time of doing this, they will sing a song. For example, this song, "Death is walking down the street. He carries a pancake on a plate. To the one whose ring is taking out, it will happen. It will happen soon. It can't be escaped." And this will foretell either marriage or death.
How?
Not entirely sure, to be honest, Barry. I was just quite taken by the horrifying rhyme.
Because all I've heard is they put a load of shit into a bowl, say something, and then equals profit. Literally profit.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Before I go to absolutely my most disgusting form of prediction, just a couple of predictions from history that were hilariously wrong. Lord Kelvin, who is always absolutely wrong, as president of the British Society in 1895, said, "Heavier than air flying machines are impossible." 8 years later, the Wright brothers took off. You have Napoleon Bonaparte, who was told about Robert Fulton's steamboat and responded going, "How so would you make a ship sail against the wind and currents by lighting a bonfire under a deck? I pray you excuse me. I have not the time to listen to such nonsense." Martin Van Buren, when governor of New York, said, "Dear Mr. President, the canal system of this country is being threatened by a new form of transportation known as railroads. As you may well know, railroad carriages are pulled at the enormous speed of 15 miles an hour. In addition to endangering life, these engines roar and snort their way through the countryside, setting fire to crops, scaring the livestock, and frightening women and children. The Almighty certainly never intended that people should travel at such breakneck speed."
I love Martin Van Buren living up to his Dutch roots there by protecting viciously the canals of America.
That almost reminds me of it. No, I don't know if it's quite a prediction, but it's my favourite famous last words thing, isn't it? American general that were fighting probably the Indians or whatever, and poked his head up above the trenches and said, "Oh, they couldn't shoot an elephant from here, don't worry." And then he just got shot immediately.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the Battle of Spotsylvania, the guy was called John Sedgwick.
Yeah.
But my nomination for the world's worst prediction is absolutely the most disgusting form of, haruspicy, which is in mid-19th century Belfast, according to the Dictionary of Superstitions, women would predict the character of their future husbands by taking the entrails of herrings and throwing them against the wall. And
and if any husband doesn't run away, they don't marry that one.
Yeah.
It's, no, like testing, it's like they're testing if pasta's cooked, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So basically, if the herring entrails were upright, then they would be marrying a good man. But if the herring entrails were crooked...
Sorry, if the herring entrails are upright, they've been having some of Pele's pills.
Yeah. but if the herring entrails are crooked, then their husband will be crooked.
I just have a gut feeling it's not going to work.
Yay!
Our nominations for the world's worst predictions are the grizzly ambulance and corpse chaser, Sylvia Brown, Peter's prediction of the greatest footballer to play the game who couldn't hit a barn door from 6 yards with his predictions, Pelé, and my nomination of all herrings in Belfast in the 19th century. I mean, Barry, yours are grisly and morally troubling. Mine are absolutely disgusting. And
physically troubling.
And physically troubling. Peter, yours are quite amusing, but also I do find the fact that the ones that Pelé predicted are so hilariously wrong, I find them kind of heartbreaking. I think, as grisly as Barry's and mine are, I think I'm going to go for yours. I think I'm going to go for Pelé. Just because I love someone so talented being so wrong.
It's the most heroic failure on brand for the podcast answer of those ones as well.
I bet to leave the best news of the week before we go, which we'll continue doing until the world gets slightly less depressing. And it's this, that an 11-year-old girl from Cambridgeshire has been nominated for a FIFA fan award. Imogen from Cambridgeshire set out to do one keepy uppy for each of the United Kingdom's key workers in April. And with the assistance of celebrities all around the world, she managed to get people to do 7.1 million keepy uppies. She did 3,000 herself over a number of attempts, including, and I'm really impressed by this, she managed to do 824 in one go. Like, my keepy uppy record is about 30.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, Imogen Papworth Heidel is her name. And joining her were Marcus Rashford. Of course, Marcus Rashford. Lucy Bronze, the English football player, and Spandau Ballet star Martin Kemp, who... I feel like Martin Kemp was also a decent footballer in his day.
Yeah, he could do a decent Kempy uppy, I think.
Yeah, no. yeah.
You just... are goal. That's about it. She's been nominated for an award by FIFA. That's so cool.
Yeah,
oh, well done her.
So, lovely, lovely news. Peter, before we go, where can our listeners find you? And what can they find you doing when they get there?
I'm on the internet. So... in the
don't expect him to be nice to you if you say hi.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter and Instagram. I have a Facebook page, but that's just an absolute mess. I can't work that, so don't bother with that. Yeah, Instagram and Twitter. If you look for Peter Brush, you'll find it, but it's slightly different handle. So Twitter is Peter_Brush and Instagram is Peter_Brush. And you can find links to my website, which has got all my gigs on it at the moment until they're all cancelled next year. So, you know, you can, if I've been enticing enough to drag you away. I mean, nice to get like 3 more followers on the back of this or something. That'd be good, wouldn't it? I mean, I don't know what you do with them. But
that's the challenge. The challenge, listeners, is for 3 of you, no more and no less, to follow Peter off the back of this episode. Decide among yourselves whose duty it is.
I mean, you know, then I'll be on trial for a bit and they'll be like, oh, we'll see what the next couple of posts are like. And then they'll be average and then they'll go, oh, you know what, not for me. But yeah, you know, it's fair enough.
But they'll have given you a fair crack.
Yeah, it's all you can ask for, isn't it?
I like how you started this show with terrible networking and have ended it with even worse self-promotion.
Well, yeah. I just like to be authentic, you know, and I sort of feel like that'll get me somewhere eventually, just a bit slower, you know. I've made it though. I do comedy for my job, and that's the minimum of, you know, it's the minimum you want now. But like, you, 10 years ago, you said that's what you were doing. I'd be absolutely delighted with that. It's a good living in some ways. You know? I mean, in many ways, it's a very stimulating, enjoyable thing. I don't want to do anything else, really. So, you know, if this is all I've got, I'm happy. So,
who are you trying to convince, Peter?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. It does sound a bit like that, doesn't it? So, I'm really happy.
Who'd have predicted he'd say that at the start of this episode?
Amazing. Well, we're all off to predict the winners of next year's British Comedy Awards by throwing Richard Herring against a wall. Until next time, goodbye.